Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Raed Jarar of the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, who assesses the state of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, where an erratic Donald Trump appears desperate to find an exit to this disastrous conflict. Nathaniel Raymond of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, who talks about a recent shift in Sudan's devastating civil war, where civilians continue to bear the brunt of the violence. And Andy Shalal, a delegate on the Nuestra America convoy to Cuba, who discusses the importance of supporting the people of Cuba with humanitarian aid in defiance of the Trump regime's energy blockade of the island nation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Life is fragile in Ecuador's high-altitude rainforest, one of the most biodiverse ecosystems on the planet. Yet servicing a $49 billion debt to foreign investors is pushing the small South American nation to expand oil drilling and production in vulnerable environments that urgently need protection. 2 years ago, Ecuador signed a debt for nature deal where the country refinanced some of its most costly debt for pennies on the dollar in exchange for agreeing to implement tough new environmental protections in the Amazonia region. Debt swaps date back to the 1980s in nations including Barbados and Seychelles, which made deals with private creditors leveraging millions of dollars for conservation. Now, academics and policymakers are leaning on China, which owns $1.3 trillion in debt owed by developing nations to move toward debt restructuring deals. Economist and China watcher Christoph Niedelfel Wang sees growing potential in China's green finance institutions, along with support from the United Nations Development Program, to transform this liability into a tool for preserving endangered ecosystems. Vietnam, a rising middle power in Southeast Asia, is expanding its international relations in order to reduce its overdependence on economic and security collaboration with China and the U.S. Hanoi recently elevated its partnerships with Algeria, Kuwait, and South Africa. These are the first African and Middle Eastern nations to receive such close engagement as Vietnam seeks new trade and other deals. Hanoi joined the 11-nation BRICS bloc of emerging economies in June to explore alternative economic channels. For many years, Hanoi has declined to participate in multilateral forums outside the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. From Vietnam's perspective, their national security existentially depends on effective diplomacy, especially as intensifying U.S.-China competition threatens to destabilize Asia and endanger Hanoi's national interests. Vietnam will likely stick to its decades-old pledge to make more friends and fewer enemies while avoiding antagonizing or becoming overly dependent on either Washington or Beijing. 2 years ago, former New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, then nominee for U.S. Representative to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, faced pointed questions in a Senate hearing about his ties to cryptocurrency companies and possible conflicts of interest in his new role. Under pressure from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Maloney agreed to immediately resign from his private sector work with cryptocurrency firms and commit to not accept employment, board service, or compensation from any crypto company or organization for 4 years after his OECD tenure. However, just 1 year after leaving the OECD, Maloney took a new job that appears to violate his commitment. He will now be the president and CEO of the Coalition for Prediction Markets, an industry, trade, and lobbying group. According to the American Prospect, Maloney's new responsibilities prioritize preventing government regulation of these gambling platforms and engaging in a public relations campaign to portray the coalition as respectable financial institutions. Prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket, in fact, incentivize customers to rig the bet themselves. Over the last year, bettors have profited by predicting the U.S. kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and more recently, in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, by placing bets on when the first bombs would drop and where they might land. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As the U.S.-Israel war against Iran entered its fourth week, American and Israeli missile attacks continued to pound Iran, while Iranian missiles and drones targeted U.S. military bases and Gulf nations' energy infrastructure. On March 21st, Iranian missiles struck near Israel's main nuclear research center at Dimona in the Negev Desert. Iran said their attack was in retaliation for an Israeli airstrike against Iran's Natanz nuclear enrichment facility. On March 21st, Donald Trump declared he would obliterate Iranian power plants within 48 hours if the Strait of Hormuz was not reopened to cargo ships and oil tankers. That's caused oil and gas prices to spike and closed down critical supply chains. Iran responded by warning it would destroy essential regional energy infrastructure, including water desalination systems, if Trump followed through on his threat. Then on March 23rd, Trump extended his deadline by 5 days, claiming that Iran and the U.S. have had productive talks to end hostilities, negotiations that Iranian officials denied were taking place. As Trump seeks $200 billion from Congress to fight the war in Iran and is deploying some 8,000 U.S. soldiers to the Middle East, Egypt, Pakistan, and Turkey have offered to broker a peace deal between the U.S. and Iran. Your reporter spoke with Rai Jarar, advocacy director with the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, that was founded by Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi before his assassination. Here, Rai discusses the current state of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran and the different goals of the two nations.
Israel and the United States are really not fighting the same war. Israel, what Netanyahu is doing, it is what he's done all over the region. He is fighting a war of destruction and domination. He's done that in Palestine. He's done that in Lebanon. He has, you know, talked about that in other places. He has attacked 7 different capitals around the region last year. And what he wants to do with Iran is the complete destruction of Iran. Because he sees Iran as a threat to Israel's hegemony in the region. He sees Iran's existence as a threat to his personal and political projects. So what he wants to do is not to create a prosperous Iran. He wants to completely destroy Iran. He wants to destroy Iran as a nation and as a nation state. Trump, on the other hand, he was duped into thinking that Iran is going to be a Venezuela. And that is actually what he believed. He thought that he's going to amass all of the U.S. forces, the same way that he amassed a lot of U.S. forces around Venezuela. And he's going to do a quick decapitation hit and insert someone else and say goodbye. And the United States in general, whether it's Trump or even Lindsey Graham or other crazy leaders in this country who have been advocating for war against Iran, they haven't really advocated for the full destruction of Iran as a nation. So when Israel started bombing Iranian oil industry and refineries, everyone is like, whoa, 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 whoa. Even Lindsey Graham came out publicly saying, oh my God, why would you attack their oil infrastructure? Because we don't want to destroy Iran. We just want to change its leadership. which is a very naive and almost laughable notion to think that the United States and Israel can just go and install a new government in Iran and leave. Like, that is, you know, not going to happen. So the answer is the United States and Israel are fighting two different wars, and we see this deviation becoming more and more and more clear every day, where Israel is trying to pull Trump into this very expensive, lengthy regime change, nation destruction kind of war. And Trump is trying to figure out what the heck he's doing there. He's in trouble. He's in very, very serious trouble. And as you said, he's trying his best to control the damage. So he, like, lies and makes up stories every morning to control the price of oil. But this is not very sustainable. Like, you can't lie your way out of war, because this is very, very serious. What we're dealing with now is a serious situation that will continue to devolve over the next few weeks and months, not hours and days.
In 2015, President Barack Obama successfully negotiated with Iran the International Nuclear Deal, JCPOA as it's called, which was, by all accounts, being observed to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Then Trump unilaterally tore up this nuclear agreement that was working, which led to the earlier U.S.-Israeli attack in June, the 12-day war, and of course the current war. Most observers, if they trace it back, will blame Trump for what we are in today. But in the aftermath of this war and the assassination of Iran's supreme leader and their whole leadership structure, there are many observers who believe that now Iran may be considering that in the aftermath of this decimation of their government, they may need to build a nuclear weapon as as the only effective deterrent to prevent a future attack. It's a scenario that I think follows some logic that we all have to understand.
So, I mean, it's obviously like conventional wisdom now that the U.S. and Israel have no respect to international law or sovereignty or U.N. charter, but it seems like they would respect strong countries with nuclear weapons. So, unfortunately, that's the new world order that is being created under this U.S. government, and like over the last decades, where the erosion of law would lead more countries to obtaining going into a nuclear race. But I'll tell you something important here. Iran has never, ever said or done anything that will indicate that they're building a nuclear weapon. And unlike Israel, they actually have signed all international treaties and got all of the inspectors of everyone to come and verify that. But now with these attacks, you know, we have 450 pounds of enriched uranium that no one knows where it is anymore. Like, it's either under some rubble or in someone's truck in their basement, you know, I don't know where they are. But what we know is that they're enough to create 11 nuclear bombs. And this is the legacy of Trump, the loose nuclear material, the giving incentives for more nuclear death and destruction.
That was Rai Jarar, advocacy director with the group Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. Find more news and analysis on the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The ongoing violence against Palestinians in Gaza has fallen out of the headlines since a largely ignored ceasefire agreement was signed in October last year, and even more so after Israel and the U.S. launched their war on Iran. But the ongoing civil war in Sudan has never been a top news headline, even though it's killed, injured, and displaced more people than any other conflict in the world today. Those impacted by the Sudan war number in the millions. The Sudanese armed forces have been battling an army known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Both sides have committed documented atrocities and war crimes. However, in late October, the RSF took control of the city of Al-Fashir in the Darfur region in western Sudan, with some reports finding they massacred up to 60,000 people. A UN independent fact-finding mission for Sudan concluded that the RSF committed genocide during their 18-month-long siege of Al-Fashir. Earlier this year, the Sudanese armed forces gained the upper hand against the Rapid Support Forces, marking a significant shift in the war. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nathaniel Raymond, executive director of Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab, who assesses the current state of this devastating conflict and the horrifying loss of life.
The Sudan Armed Forces have gained military advantage due to the disruption of United Arab Emirates supply flights to the RSF. And the Sudan Armed Forces have broken the siege on two other cities in an area of the country outside Darfur called the Kordofans. And now they are taking the fight back to the RSF. The effort to reach a negotiated settlement to the war is still ongoing by the international community through a process that has been called the Quad because it involves four countries. But meanwhile, it has largely been theater because the RSF has no intent to reach a humanitarian truce. And now the Sudan Armed Forces, after having basically been losing for the better part of a year since recapturing Khartoum and Omdurman, now has no initiative to negotiate with the RSF because they're gaining the upper hand militarily. The fact of the matter is that civilians are continuing to suffer from immense food insecurity, what's known as integrated phase classification level 5, which is the highest level of food insecurity in several areas of the country, while others have the extremely difficult designation of IPC level 4, including in areas outside Darfur. The rapid support forces, with the attack on Al-Fashir and the subsequent massacre involving the use of an earthen wall to trap the population, has been found by the UN fact-finding mission as of last month to have committed genocide in Al-Fashir. Last week, we released with NASA a report based on almost 2 years of research that found that the rapid support forces intentionally caused famine and mass starvation in Al-Fashir in North Darfur by burning agricultural communities to force farmers to flee to miss a planting season. And we were able to show the destruction of 41 communities and the subsequent mass collapse of farming capacity in those communities. And so that helped confirm the UN's findings of intentional starvation as part of a campaign of genocide against the four Nzagawa ethnic people who live in the area surrounding Al-Fashir. So the situation is changing rapidly, but it continues to be a battlefield that largely is defined by mass suffering of civilians.
Nathaniel Raymond, we've been talking about Sudan, but I'm also hearing about recurring violence in South Sudan, which is a huge country that seceded from Sudan in 2011. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of violence there almost from that time. What can you tell us about what's been going on recently?
Now it looks like the Nuer-Dinka conflict is about to explode again. I served in the UN mission South Sudan as an advisor to the Department of Peacekeeping Operations for Mass Atrocity Early Warning in 2015. And so I know South Sudan well, and have worked on South Sudan on and off for 15 years. And so I've already been receiving panicked calls from the ground, including from members of the Christian community there, who are worried that this next round of large-scale violence could meet and exceed the killings in 2013, which displaced thousands and killed thousands. And so the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab is trying to figure out what we can do to be ready to assist on South Sudan, because we know that area so well, and because our methods could bring unique information, particularly early warning information of potential arson attacks on communities of different ethnic groups, not just Nuer and Dinka. There are many sub-tribes and many large tribal groups with different sub-tribes as part of it in South Sudan, which would be affected by any return to war between the Dinka and the Nuer. And so we're figuring out what we can do, and we're getting ready to assist.
That was Nathaniel Raymond, Executive Director of Yale University's Humanitarian Research Lab. Learn more about the investigations into the genocide being committed in Sudan's civil war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Responding to the Trump regime's blockade of international oil deliveries to Cuba, some 650 delegates from 33 countries and 120 organizations began arriving in Cuba on March 20th as part of the Solidarity Nuestra America convoy to Cuba. About 20 metric tons of food, medical supplies, and solar panels arrived by air and sea in an effort to support the people of Cuba, who've suffered under a six-decade American economic embargo and more recent constant electricity blackouts that's resulted in the inability of hospitals to store critical medicines and provide needed care for newborns, their mothers, the elderly, and the sick. The convoy, organized by Progressive International, Code Pink Women for Peace, and dozens of other non-governmental organizations, included four members of the European Parliament, French, Spanish, and Colombian legislators, as well as Jeremy Corbyn, former leader of Britain's Labour Party. Your reporter spoke with Andy Shalal, owner of the Busboys and Poets bookstores and progressive cultural hubs in Washington, D.C., and a delegate on the Nuestra America convoy, who talks about the importance of supporting the people of Cuba with humanitarian aid in defiance of the Trump administration's energy blockade.
It affects everyday people, of course, on a regular basis. It affects hospitals, it affects research centers, it affects schools, it affects after-school care, it affects art companies, dance companies, you name it. I mean, everything depends on lights and electricity and power. And when you cut that off, it's a huge impact on everything that we do. We sort of take for granted that we just flip a switch and light goes on. But they cook also with gas and oil and electricity. And of course, if you're living in an apartment, I was told first as someone that lives in an apartment, they said they wish they lived in a house. At least they could cook with wood that they can scavenge and cook with it. We're talking about sending a whole population back, decades and decades, if not 100 years, in how we operate. I mean, they have to gather wood in order to cook their meals. Imagine that. And of course, electricity also runs water purification systems. It runs sewage systems. It runs everything that we do. So that's really become a huge problem. Cuba has gone through these periods before. You had a period that's been referred to as the special period, which happened right after the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 91. And that lasted for many, many, many years, until the Bolivarian Revolution that happened, of course, with Venezuela to bring in Chavez into power. And when Chavez came into power, of course, they started producing oil and giving it to Cuba. So it raised the standards back up again. But then, you have this current situation that's been completely out of control. Not only have they blocked oil from Venezuela, but they blocked any oil from anywhere. And not only that, but they have a complete blockade around the island that no one can bring any products in. So things like basic food products, very, very expensive for ordinary Cubans that are living there. So it's been very difficult. I've seen the deterioration. We've been going there for almost 15 years, and I've seen it year after year after year where things have started to become more problematic for ordinary Cubans.
Andy, tell us about the international activists. Those coming from the U.S. and Europe, I had heard that there were four members of the European Parliament, Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the U.K.'s Labour Party, Pablo Iglesias, former leader of Spain's Podemos Party, and others. Give us a general overview of this delegation and what they brought to Cuba in terms of humanitarian aid.
you know, everyone that goes to Cuba almost has to bring something. You know, we bring bags full of medicine and supplies for young people, like coloring pencils and paper. Paper is a shortage. You can't find paper. I remember even a couple of years ago, my wife was feeling ill when we were in Cuba. She had to go to the hospital. And they didn't have Band-Aids. I mean, the syringes, they have to reuse them. They have to autoclave them and reuse them. So they don't have disposable syringes. These are really basic things that people need nowadays to be able to function as a normal society. All these things have been blocked. There were over 400 delegates from all over the world that were there, people that came to say no to the blockade, let Cuba live. You know, had a huge plenary with the president and other folks from the government to talk about this issue. And really, the solidarity was quite beautiful to see it. People spoke from different countries. There's lots of representation, different flags from different countries, and all of them stating the same thing, that the United States has played an outsized role in blocking even some of those countries from doing what they want to do as far as humanitarian aid to Cuba. So the United States right now is at war with almost every single country in the world. And it's not always a hot war. It's also an economic war. So using tariffs to blackmail countries from, you know, being doing their thing, you know, like being sovereign. It was wonderful to see so many people from so many different countries in solidarity to really speak up and let the Cuban people know that they're not alone. Because a lot of times I think in these kinds of situations, having delegations there and having presence there really brings hope to the folks that are there to know that they're not alone. There are people that see them and hear them and are fighting on their behalf. So that's really exciting to see.
That was Andy Shalal, owner of the Busboys and Poets bookstores and progressive cultural hubs in Washington, D.C., and a delegate on the Nuestra America convoy to Cuba. Find more information and commentary on the U.S.-Cuba energy blockade and groups working to provide humanitarian aid by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on APS Radio in Milford, Connecticut, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, KMUD in Laytonville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.